This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, there's a lot coming up. A lot happened, of course. We had the elections on Tuesday. It looks like the Democrats are doing very well, and more to come. Denver, for all practical purposes, decriminalizing pot. That's kind of cool. Portland is close to that, I think. I think it's like a traffic ticket. Or in that neighborhood, anyhow. And Democratic candidates doing well all over the country, although the Republicans this morning sent out in their talking points to their right-wing talk show hosts, and there's reprints of it in other places on the web. There's one over at the Daily Kos, a memo talking about how well the Republicans did in the Tuesday elections. Yes. I guess you get your bennies where you can get them. In the second hour of our program today, we are going to have an hour-long debate about 9/11. What happened on 9/11, and how did it come about? In the third hour of our program, Christy Harvey is going to be here with the Center for American Progress, Isaiah Poole and Rob Call from TomPaine.com and OpEdNews.com about what's going on in the blogosphere. And in our first hour, there's an amazing amount of news in the headlines here today that I'd like to talk to you about. And the main issue, I think, is given that we've got a Fed meeting coming up, given that what's happening in Pakistan, given what's happening in Iraq and Iran, what is the impact going to be of $100 a gallon oil? What are the consequences of this? $100 barrel oil. And because, frankly, I mean, there's a lot of theories out there. They're floating around. Oh, you know, the price of oil is really the consequence U.S. saber rattling against Iran. My take on this, my sense of it, is that the U.S. saber rattling against Iran maybe is adding $5 to $10 to the barrel of oil. But what's really driving up the price of oil is two things. One is that we really and truly probably are hitting peak oil right now. We're probably there. I mean, you know, it's just time to acknowledge it. The supply of oil in the world, at least the easily accessible supply of oil in the world, is now here. Now, most people, I think, don't realize we hit peak oil in the United States in the 1970s. I'm old enough to remember oil wells in the Midwest when I was a little kid. And they used to pump oil out of Ohio. Most of that went away in the 1940s and 50s. I was born in 51. I remember oil wells in Michigan when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s. They're, you know, out in farmers' farms, you know, just pumping away, just like sort of like, you know, in Beverly Hills, I guess there's one near the high school or something. You see them occasionally around in various places. And in fact, you know, John Rockefeller used to be Standard Oil of Ohio, you know, but that was because he had exhausted the oil in New Jersey. The first commercial oil well in the United States was in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and as I recall, 1856, Colonel Drake drilled the first commercially viable oil well in the United States. And thus the Pennsylvania Oil Company, Pennoil, or Pennzoil. And so the United States was one of the major producers in the world of oil, and actually still is. It's one of the top 10 producers of oil in the world. I think we're number 5 or 6 in the world in terms of production. A lot of that is including Alaskan oil and North Slope oil. But we're also the largest consumer of oil in the world. And we hit peak oil in 1974. You know, looking back on it now, we can look at that was the point. Up until the mid-70s, the United States was an exporter of oil as well as an importer of oil. We would import oil into some places in the United States, and you know, it was more abundant on the West Coast than on the East Coast. We would import it into the East Coast, and we used it more heavily in the East Coast because the East and the Midwest was where the industrial concentration was, and we were exporting it out of the West Coast. But we were a net exporting oil company through the 20, basically from 1850, the 1860s or 1870s, we were exporting oil right up until the 1970s. And we still actually export a small amount of oil. But by and large, ever since the 1970s, we have been an oil importing country, and we've been very dependent upon imported oil. And in 74, it appears, sometime between 72 and 76, and the broad consensus is 74, we hit peak oil in the United States. And the consequence of that was that we suddenly became dependent upon the rest of the world. Literally, for the engine that would drive our economy. And Jimmy Carter addressed this. I mean, he came right out and addressed this. This is in 1979, July 15, 1979. He said, hey, this is real. Because Nixon was president, actually, when we hit peak oil. And that was about the time that there was the war in the Middle East and the Arabs, because we supported Israel, declared a boycott on selling oil to the United States. I remember Louise and I were living in Detroit at the time. In fact, she was pregnant with our oldest child. I was, I think, 72, 73, Louise, whatever year that was. And the people were shooting each other in traffic lines. I mean, in lines waiting to get, you'd have to sit in line literally for 8 to 10 hours to get gas. And if somebody tried to take cuts, people would take shots at them. And I know at least one person died. I remember the news stories. And within 3 days, and Michigan went to alternate, even, you know, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. If your license plate ended in an even number, you could get gas. If it was, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, or Sunday, you could do it if your last digit of your license plate was an odd number. You maximum 5 gallons, rationing gas, basically. I mean, this was during the Nixon administration. And it was incredible. It was insane. And I remember, and then the Teamsters went on strike because the price of gas went up so high, and they were, you know, hey, we're not going to put up with this. And I remember it took about 3 days for all the supermarkets around us in Detroit to go empty. I mean, you know, you could still walk in and find maybe antifreeze, but you couldn't find food. And so here now, 6 years after that, 5, 6, 7 years after that, Jimmy Carter, July 15th, 1979, he said, you know, that wasn't just a weird exception. That wasn't just because Nixon was, you know, that wasn't just because of the Six-Day War, the war in the Middle East. That wasn't just, you know, that was because we have, he didn't use the phrase peak oil, but that's because we are now dependent upon Middle Eastern oil, essentially for our survival, and we have to change that. And so, you know, Jimmy Carter came out and said, you know, we're going to do something about that. We're going to legislatively. This is something that only government can do. You can't rely on the so-called private sector, end quote. In other words, you can't rely on the big corporations to do it for you. The so-called free market, the corporate free market. You can't rely on the big corporate free market. You have to. This is something that we're going to have to do, and we're going to do it.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Yeah.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, Jimmy Carter actually put that legislation into place. And had his policies remained, had Ronald Reagan not come in with all that oil money and just rolled back those policies, we would not be looking at $100 barrel oil right now. We would not have a war in the Middle East over oil. We would not have the Arab world inflamed against us. Osama bin Laden never would have gone after us because we never would have had a war in Kuwait. And therefore, we never would have staged our soldiers out of the Bin Sultan Air Force Base in Saudi Arabia, which was, according to Osama bin Laden, the main reason why he attacked us, because we were defiling Saudi soil. So what's the impact of this going to be? There's a half a dozen stories this morning in the Financial Times. It's all over the financial press, the business press of the world about what's happening with oil. This commentary by Gideon Rachman about $100 oil would have a big political impact. The effects of rising oil on the economies of producing countries are dramatic. OPEC, for example, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in 1998, they made $110 billion from selling oil. Last year, from selling oil, now that we're, you know, last year oil was on average probably around $60, $70 a barrel. Last year they made $650 billion. Russian oil and gas revenues have quadrupled over the same period. Tyrannical governments sitting in oil fields are more likely to find protection from powerful oil-consuming countries. China, for example, is buddying up with Burma and Sudan. So we're going to see a more brutal world as a consequence of this. We're going to see more Musharrafs as a consequence of this. We're going to see massive dislocations in the U.S. economy. We're already starting to see it. And yesterday we even had the French president, and this was the subtext to his speech, and frankly I'm guessing that most people missed it entirely, Sarkozy lecturing George Bush about how he had to do something about the so-called free market. I'll tell you about that right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Suddenly I see Tom's schedule here. Tomorrow I'll be in Phoenix. We'll be doing our show live from KPHX. And I will be doing a gig at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills in Tempe from 3 to 5 p.m. You have to pick up tickets for this one. It's going to be a talk. I'll basically be in word and theatrical gesture sharing with you the contents of my new book, Cracking the Code. From 3 to 5 p.m., and you have to pick them up at 1480kphx.com. On Monday, I'll be in Philadelphia at the White Dog Cafe, the 6 o'clock dinner, 7:30, a talk on cracking the code. That's on 3420 Sansom Street in Philadelphia. On Tuesday, the November 13th, I'll be at the Strand Bookstore in New York City, signing my new book, Cracking the Code. By the way, Louise is out of the room right now. She's not listening. The 11th, I'll be on the road. We're gonna celebrate our anniversary a week late. We're just gonna move the time because she's staying here and I'm traveling. Although I tried to talk her into traveling with me, but it's our 35th wedding anniversary. So send her a note saying, congratulations or hey, how did you put up with that guy all those years or whatever? Because she can't hear me right now. I'm not joking. I mean she's on the cell phone out in the other room. That's November 11th, our anniversary. November 13th, I'll be at the Strand Bookstore in New York City. My friend Richard Belzer is going to introduce me. Book TV, C-SPAN is expected to show up and will be signing Cracking the Code. That'll be at 7 o'clock Tuesday in New York. Wednesday in New York, we'll be at Demos. And Mark Green, the president of Air America, I believe, is going to be introducing me. I'm looking forward to that. And it's always great to see Mark. And I'll be, again, talking about Cracking the Code. That'll be at 5:30 p.m. On Friday of this week in San Francisco at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City, 3:30 to 6 p.m. Again, you need tickets for that. For that, you go to green60.com. And on November 17th in Carmel, California, in conjunction with KRXA, our affiliate in Monterey, I'll be at the Pilgrim's Way bookstore. And so a lot coming up. Anyhow, that's what I'm seeing in my schedule. China, back to this, you know, what's the consequence of $100 barrel oil? See, I see this as part of a much, much larger picture. Let me just lay some things out and then thread them together. Yesterday, the Duma in Russia, the lower house, their equivalent of the House of Representatives, by a 418-0 vote, voted to allow Russia to stop complying with the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty. Now, this is a treaty that was passed back during the Reagan era, as I recall. In fact, I think I have the date here. Yeah, it was adopted in 1990. Now, that would have been the last year of which election was which? Yeah, that would have been during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and the Duma said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. This is basically the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty froze the level of weaponry. In other words, it said, no, we're not going to build up any more massive armies so that we have another world war in Europe. Russia voted yesterday 418-0 to ignore that treaty. their official ignoring or unsigning of the treaty is going to take place on December 12th. Addressing the Duma, this is from the Financial Times, Neil Buckley reporting from Moscow. Addressing the Duma, General Yuri Belyavetsky, chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces, said the CFE treaty discriminated against Russia. He said the treaty allows practically without restrictions realization of the strategy of moving NATO eastwards and reconfiguring the U.S. military presence in Europe. In other words, they're concerned that we are getting around the treaty by bringing more and more U.S. forces in. And really, I think the bottom line is that Russia is trying to consolidate their hold over the oil in the Caspian Sea, the Balkans, and whatever oil resources may be, you know, in the former Soviet states heading down into Europe, and their ability to sell oil. Russia is one of the major oil providers to Western Europe and Northern Europe and the Scandinavian countries, and some of them. Mr. Putin threatened in April, by the way, to suspend the treaty, and then he did it. So there's that threat. There's the threat of Bhutto. She is drawing a hard line with regard to Musharraf. General Musharraf, she says she's going to have a long march to the East Pakistan city of Lahore if Musharraf doesn't keep his promise to retire from the military by November 15th to step down. You have the U.S. tipping point may be reached. This regulatory warning for U.S. markets, this by Jeremy Grant in Washington from the Financial Times. The U.S. may have reached a tipping point where the inability of its legal and regulatory system to adapt to new global methods of regulation is putting the competitiveness of U.S. capital markets at risk. And then to top the whole thing off, and whatever you want to call it, it's just absolutely incredible. This is in the Washington Times, of all places. China roiled financial markets around the globe yesterday when it asserted the dollar is losing its luster as the world's reserve currency and that Beijing will swap some of its $1.4 trillion in reserves out of U.S. dollars and into stronger currencies like the euro and the Canadian dollar. Zhu Jian, the central bank vice director of China, said, quote, "The world's currency structure has changed. The dollar is losing its status as the world's currency." This drove the dollar up down to 150 to the euro. And the stock market is crashing. The dollar is crashing. All of this, the consequence of the failure ever since Reagan to pay attention to Jimmy Carter.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Bush got to do it. The mouth of lies are spoken.
Who needs a law when the law can be broken?
Who needs a law when a law can be broken? Yeah. What's Bush got to do with it? Oh, man. $9 trillion. $9 trillion. See, again, I'm laying all this stuff out because, you know, it's like a crossword puzzle. Or not. Well, a jigsaw puzzle. You get all these pieces together, and what is this that I'm looking at? And then you lay them all down, and you look at them, and you go, oh, that's what it is. That's what it is. $9 trillion in debt. For the first time ever, the United States has gone $9 trillion in debt. Now, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the U.S. debt was a little under $2 trillion, as I recall. And that was, you know, that was substantial. That was a big chunk of that was left over from the Vietnam War. Ronald Reagan borrowed more money than every president in the history of the United States. And as Dick Cheney said a couple of years ago, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Well, the fact of the matter is that we're paying interest on the national debt right now, to the tune of somewhere in the neighborhood around $700 per American family. I mean, it's amazing the amount of money that we're spending on interest on the national debt. And now Bush has borrowed another $4 trillion, more or less, since he came into office. And so now we're pushing $9 trillion in debt. The only president from Reagan until today to have done anything about that at all was Bill Clinton. God bless him for that. Isn't it ironic that we've had, four Republican presidencies, three Republican presidents, five Republican terms in office, and one Democratic president in the middle of that, and the only one of all those 26 years who actually seriously did anything about being fiscally responsible was the Democrat. But George Bush just signed a measure, actually he signed it in September, to increase the debt ceiling to $9.815 trillion from $8.965 trillion, and we just now, today, hit $9 trillion in debt. So we hit $9 trillion in debt. China looks at us and says, we don't trust your currency anymore. It's funny money. It hasn't been based on gold since Richard Nixon was president, another gift to us from the Republicans. And the price of oil is going $100 a barrel, in part, I think, because we've hit peak oil, in part because of our saber rattling, and in large part because the dollar's crashing. See, if you live in Germany right now and you're buying oil, 5 years ago, $100 a barrel oil would have cost, when the euro was 90 cents to the dollar. You could buy a euro for 90 cents. How to phrase this? You could buy 1 euro for 90 U.S. cents. Okay? So, $100 worth of oil would have cost 90 euros. $100 barrel oil. Now that the euro is $1.50, it takes $1.50 to buy a euro. They can buy a $100 barrel of oil for what? I can't do my math, my fractions, inverse fractions that fast, but I think it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $70. In other words, the Europeans are not being hit as badly as we are. The Canadians are not being hit as badly as we are. Their currency's gone up almost twice as fast as ours, so $100 barrel oil is actually only costing them $50 a barrel for all practical purposes, compared to 5 or 6 years ago, compared to pre-Bush. So our currency is collapsing. Our country is getting poorer. And Sarkozy, this is the amazing thing. Sarkozy comes before Congress. And I'm just wondering how many people heard this and noticed this. Now I'm going to take your calls and get your thoughts on this. But this is amazing. This, again, from the Financial Times today. Ben Hall reporting in Washington. Nicolas Sarkozy, this, of course, the French president, used the first speech by a French leader to the U.S. Congress for more than a decade to attack the excesses of Wall Street yesterday. Now, in the American press, this is the first sentence of the first paragraph of the Financial Times article. In the American press, it was all about Sarkozy's with us on Iran. We're going to beat up Iran. Well, sort of. But the rest of the world is talking about the fact that Sarkozy pointed out that this, Naomi Klein calls neoliberalism, or actually what she calls corporatism, what David Harvey calls neoliberalism, what Europeans refer to as neoliberalism, what I refer to as Reaganomics, conservative economic policies, insane policies, Friedmanism, whether it's Milton or Thomas, take your choice. It's all crazy. It's all plain old flat out insane, and it's brought the United States to the brink of economic destruction. And Sarkozy, the French president, comes over here and wags his finger in our face and says, you guys are nuts. So back to the story. This is the Financial Times, the first three paragraphs. I mean, it just lays it right out. Nicolas Sarkozy used the first speech by a French leader to the U.S. Congress for more than a decade to attack the excesses of Wall Street yesterday, criticizing the land of free enterprise for being too tolerant of financial speculation. He said pro-Americans, that's you and me, people who love and believe in America, should be the first to criticize. And now I'm quoting the president, Sarkozy, the vagaries and excesses of financial capitalism that currently leaves too much room for financial speculation. The U.S. should become strongly engaged in the introduction of necessary financial market rules and safeguards. The French president said the dollar should not remain solely a problem for others. So here the president of France comes over and says, your idea of neoliberalism, your idea of deregulation, your idea that government is a bad thing.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Here you got Sarkozy coming over and saying 26 years of Americans believing that Reagan was right are destroying not just your country, but the rest of us could go down with you, and we're not happy about it. In the Middle East, in the meantime, just look at these headlines. This is just from the just a couple of headlines from today's Financial Times. IEA sounds huge alarm over energy demands. Watchdog fears threat to supplies. I mean, they're talking about, you know, again, peak oil. Middle East countries continue to hold the key. UN fears increase in hunger as cost of food rises. I mean, it's just going on and on and on. It's you put all these pieces on the table. You look at this giant jigsaw puzzle, and you can only see one thing. And that is that when this nation turned away from the policies of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal that were in place from the 1930s up until the end of the Carter presidency, when we had some sanity, and turned toward the policies of the so-called corporate free market with Ronald Reagan, and we've been there ever since for 26 years, we sealed our fate. And I think it's not too late to pull out. It's not too late to pull back. You've got this expansion of the NAFTA vote is going to come up tomorrow. Bernanke this morning on the Today Show pushing for it. It's time to call Congress and say, no more insane trade deals. In fact, shut them all down. Pull out of the WTO. Pull out of NAFTA. It's time to have a rational trade policy that protects America. It's time to protect the dollar. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. J.R. in Redding, California. Hey, J.R., what's on your mind today?
Well, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but, well, we'll all get better. We have no choice.
I hear you. I'm down here in California, but I live in Washington. I'm doing. Been noticing the price of fuel and whatnot, and I tell you, I'm kind of paranoid about this. It's getting to the point where I put in $100 and some bucks in my fuel tank to go from Longview to Portland to commute to work, and
right.
It's getting to the point that. I can't put any money in the bank, you know?
Yeah, I'm guessing that you're an independent trucker. You're having to pay for your own fuel.
Well, no, I drive for a company, but the problem is any company out there can only afford to pass the buck along to the customer for so long.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's to the point now that I see people cutting back on everything they're doing. That's reflecting
yep.
in the stock market.
That's right.
Today.
That's right. There was another story in the Financial Times this morning, or maybe it was the Wall Street Journal, about how rising fuel prices are probably going to cut back Christmas purchases. You know, gas is over $3 a barrel. Actually, I think it was USA Today this morning. I've read a whole bunch of newspapers this morning. But you're absolutely right. And for folks like you, or actually for folks who are like independent truckers who have to pay for their own fuel, we really need to have a rational energy policy. Dick Cheney was put in charge of the Energy Task Force when he came in, when he and Bush were installed by the Supreme Court in power in 2001. And his Energy Task Force should have been putting together a rational energy policy for the United States. Instead, they conspired criminally, in my opinion, in private, in secret, with the heads of the big oil companies to transfer more of your and my tax dollars to those big oil companies and to screw the rest of us and to forget about doing anything with alternative fuels and to absolutely do nothing whatsoever to protect independent truckers. And JR, you're spot on. We got a real problem here that we've got to do something about. Stuart in Seattle, we got about a half a minute before a break here. What's up, Stuart?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, you said that Reagan started office with a $2 trillion deficit. I believe he started with a $1 trillion deficit. He doubled the military spending, cut in half tax collection by eliminating most taxes for the rich,
right.
And then left us double the size of
yeah.
our national
debt. It was $1 trillion and change. And I don't recall if the change was closer to one or closer to two, but it was...
They doubled it
yeah.
from $1
yeah.
trillion to $2 trillion.
Uh-huh.
They call them tax and spend Democrats. No, it's borrow and spend Republicans.
There you go. Exactly, Stuart. Thank you very much. Good
Thanks.
To hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rob in Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today?
Tom Hartman, it's where you're right on. It's one of those things where I wish I had the optimism that you did. It's one of those things where right now I think that America has reached a point of no return. It's one of those things where 30 years ago, Jimmy Carter would have put us on the right path to be a little bit of a better country. But the whole thing is with all of the neoconservative and all of their policies over the last 30 years, it's where right now America has got to be able to pay a price. And the whole thing is where it's going to hurt all of us.
Yeah, I don't think we're at a point of no return, but I think we're at a point where we've already been badly wounded by this. We are going to be wounded worse, and if we don't elect political leaders who get it and who will do something about it and who can actually recover. I mean, look at the damage the Republicans did in the 19-teens and the 1920s that led to the Republican Great Depression. It took the better part of 10 years for a Democrat to put this country back together, Franklin Roosevelt, and get us back on our feet. I think that we can. You know, we've recovered from a lot in the past. I think we can recover again. But I agree with you that these guys have for the proverbial bowl of porridge, they have sold it. Well, actually, for power. I mean, that's the bottom line. They have sold us off, and it's a shame. It's an absolute shame. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Sean in San Francisco. Hey, Sean. Sean, you're on the air. Sean, you're... I'm sorry, I'd already moved to push the button. There's a second or so delay there. Sean, give us a call back. Rod in Fort Lee, New Jersey. Hey, Rod.
Hey, yeah, Tom. I have a couple questions for you. What is your take on a couple of major events that's not been covered in the media in the United States? The first one, which is the summit of the Five Nation Caspian Sea, the surrounding Caspian Sea, where the treaty that they signed, and none of these countries would allow any other foreign attack on their from their lands on any of these countries, including Iran and Russia, Azerbaijan, I think Kazakhstan. And
let me give you my take on that, is that everybody's getting ready for oil being so valuable and so rare and so scarce that countries like Russia are willing to go to war over it. And alliances are forming. This is very much like before World War One. And when it gets really tight and really bad, what we could see is something very much like what we saw in World War One, where a seemingly unconnected incident, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, triggers these interlocking treaties where country A says, hey, I'll protect you if you're hit. And then country B says, okay, you just got hit, but I said I'd protect country C. And you get this chain effect, and it leads to a world war that nobody can figure out how or why it started.
And the other issue is that what's going on right now as we speak in Georgia, where the chaos and demonstrations and all these people was in the street, their demonstration against the pro-American government. And the Georgian government, they claim that the Russian is involved in just, fueling this demonstrations. And they actually kicked all the diplomats of the Russians to Russia. And Russia is having, they're building the troops on the borders of Georgia. I mean, and you don't see this here in the news. And I feel that it's like kind of a run state media here.
Yeah, it is. It's worse than a state-run media here in the United States, because at least in countries where you have a state-run media, there's a healthy skepticism about the media and what it has to say. Whereas here in the United States, that healthy skepticism is by and large gone. It's lost. What we have is infotainment. We don't have true information. And you're absolutely right. The real issues, the things that we should be paying attention to and be saying, hey, what's going on with this thing? We're by and large ignoring, and it's bad. It's wrong. It's dangerous.
But that is a dangerous development that's happening in Russia. In Georgia. I'm sorry. And this is just going nuts.
I agree. And it's not just Georgia. It's also Azerbaijan. You're also seeing the same thing in Kazakhstan. You're seeing the same thing in Turkmenistan. You're seeing the same thing. All the countries around the Caspian Sea that have oil, or are bordering countries that have oil, or that have the ability to have access to the Caspian Sea to transport oil, or through which oil lines need to run or natural gas lines need to run. It's a powder keg. And that's why I think Putin is consolidating his power, because he sees which way the wind is blowing, and he doesn't trust democracy.
I mean, the way I see it right now, it's really, it's a kind of a survival war. What's happening between the West and the East and the Far East, it's kind of a jungle. It's a jungle law.
That's what it's becoming, because everything is dependent upon this one resource, oil. And somebody in the chat room pointed out water. You know, what about peak water? Yeah, we're there, too. We're already seeing water wars, and within the next 5 years, you're going to start seeing water wars between the states in the United States, not shooting wars, but legal wars. It's already happening. And you're going to see start shooting water wars in the rest of the world. So between oil and water, and both of these are things that everybody understood in the 60s and 70s, and that you had the president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, out there talking about openly and loudly, we've got to do something about this. And European leaders saying, yes, let's go along with it. Reagan comes in and Thatcher comes in, and they basically set the tone for, yes, there's going to be problems, but if we simply turn everything over to multinational corporations and the multinational corporate free market, that will solve all our problems. And all it has done is exacerbate our problems. It's made things far worse. Rod, spot on. Well said. Thank you very much. Frank in Los Angeles. Got about a minute here before we're going to wrap up this hour.
Reagan is the biggest disaster that happened to this country. You know, if you fall off a ladder, that's an accident. But when it comes to politics, that's contrived and that's manipulated. And he was put in there for one purpose, to accomplish what he did.
Roll back the New Deal.
The middle class and give the corporations power that they've never had before in their life.
Well, actually, they did have during the Gilded Age in the 1890s and 1880s and 1890s, and they did have in the 1920s and the early 1930s. And what it brought about was the Great Panic of 1898 and the Great Depression of 1929. And it has the potential to bring it about again. We're at least at the very edge of it. And if we don't get our control of our political machine soon and do something about it, we're going to be in big trouble.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, second hour of our program. What actually happened on 9/11? And why is this an enduring mystery, I guess, shall we say? And I just, first of all, I want to establish where I stand on this, and secondly, the ground rules of this thing. Lamar Waldron and I spent 17 years researching who killed Jack Kennedy. The killing of Kennedy, which happened in 63 when I was 12 years old, was the defining event for my generation. Jack, Robert, Martin Luther King, I mean, there's conspiracy theories around all of them. And Lamar and I spent 17 years, well over $100,000, maybe as much as twice that in dollars, investigating this thing, suing the federal government, filing FOIA filings, getting thousands of documents declassified. We ended up writing an 840-page book with over 2,400 footnotes, which was made into a made-for-TV, a one-hour special by NBC, which shows about every month on the Discovery Channel. And the book is called Ultimate Sacrifice, about the Kennedy assassination. And I can tell you, having shown up many, many years, every year down in Dallas is the, quote, conspiracy nut convention. And I that's what the outsiders call it, the JFK Researchers Convention, and where people share notes and try and figure out what's going on. And Lamar and I think we actually figured it out. But I can tell you, it took 17 years, and it took a hell of a lot of work. And I'm very skeptical of anybody who says, I know absolutely what went on, or I know absolutely what didn't go on. So my position is very agnostic on this. I think it's going to take, you know, I mean, here we are with the JFK assassination 40 years later. I think it's going to, 44 years later. I think it's going to take a long time to figure out. That said, I think that a good, healthy discussion, a good, healthy debate, and raising the questions, and for that matter, raising the answers to the questions, is a reasonable and healthy thing. Michael Shermer is with us. He's the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the executive director of the Skeptics Society, their website, skeptic.com. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Sorry.
And Kevin Ryan is with us. He's the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, the former site manager for Underwriter Laboratories in South Bend, and the website journalof911studies.com. Kevin Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both with us. Michael is taking the position. Well, I'm not even going to try and characterize you guys' position. My goal here, my job here is to moderate. The one thing I'm going to ask is that each of you keep your questions or answers relatively short and that nobody try to filibuster the other. It's just, you know, and if it happens, I'll just jump in. So let's start, first of all, with you, Kevin. You're taking opening statement.
Oh, okay. Well, really what it looks like we have here, we have a couple of hypotheses, and it's different than JFK because it's not really a question of a conspiracy theory or not. That term actually is wrong for several reasons here, because unless you believe that the crimes of 9/11 were committed by one person acting alone, you believe in a conspiracy theory. Actually, you don't believe in a theory at all. You believe in some sort of hypothesis because the two major hypotheses are both not well accepted. The official hypothesis is that Al-Qaeda, with no help from any government agency, committed these irrational acts of violence, and we're not really sure why. It requires extreme negligence on the part of numerous government agencies, and multiple false stories have been told. And in the end, it just gives us a reason to invade these strategically important lands. And on the other hand, we've got this alternative hypothesis that suggests that government agencies were involved and either let it happen or made it happen. And in other words, the crimes of 9/11 were committed by those with the means to accomplish them and those who benefit from the war on terror. So along with that is, if you believe in, if you lean toward the alternative hypothesis, you also believe there's very likely been an intentional cover-up, which can be seen as a greater crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Michael Shermer, Kevin suggesting if both of you, if I re-paraphrase something incorrectly, feel free to correct me and jump in. But just for the sake of brevity, sometimes I'll restate something shortly. My sense of what Kevin just said is that it definitely was a conspiracy. The question is, was it a conspiracy by Al-Qaeda, by a small band of Muslim extremists, or was it a conspiracy by the federal government, or people within the government, or people within the United States, or was it a conspiracy by both? Your response?
Well, Al-Qaeda, of course, is a conspiracy, and you know, they said they did it. They said they were proud they did it. They would do it again if they could. And they have a long history of doing those sorts of things. Don't forget that the World Trade Center was already attacked in 1993. Over 1,000 people were injured in that truck bomb attack. There was all the countless bombings of U.S. embassies throughout the 90s that Clinton had to deal with. Thwarted attempts like at LAX by Al-Qaeda. And so obviously, you know, when you have that kind of evidence, and then we have to think about the economy of explanation. That is it possible for 19 people to do that versus, say, thousands of Bush operatives secretly running around planning demolition bombs in the World Trade Center buildings for months or years ahead of time without getting caught? The reason we tend to favor conspiracy theories is I think we have a cognitive dissonance between the size of the event and the size of the cause. We tend to think huge, massive events like 9/11 should have an equally massive, complex cause. But in fact, it's just the opposite, that it would be much easier for 19 people to hide in the nooks and crannies of a free democratic society like the one in which we live and get away with these sorts of things versus thousands of operatives that would have to be involved if the U.S. government orchestrated, not to mention the issue of can the U.S. government, which can hardly do anything with competence, manage to pull this off with great confidence and competence, and nobody ever even spill the beans? I mean, look what happens to our U.S. Spies or former government agencies, Bush agents, Bush operatives, Bush administration members. What happens when they leave office? They write books. They go on Larry King Live. They spill the beans. They tell all kinds of national secrets and stories in order to sell their books and whatnot. Not one person has done that in relation to 9/11 if it was a government conspiracy, which is exactly what we would expect.
Okay, so Kevin Ryan, it sounds to me like what Michael is saying is Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is probably the right one.
Yeah, I you know, personally, I believe also that it's very likely that the truth is simple, but it's not obvious. And I've heard Michael use the complexity argument on both sides for this issue, but again, we have two hypotheses is what we've got. One, in really what separates them is the question of were government agencies involved. So if we can agree with the fact that there is such a thing as Al-Qaeda, and one important question is what historical facts about Al-Qaeda and these alleged hijackers should make people skeptical of the official hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's clear that if you look through the history that Al-Qaeda is a product of the CIA's Afghanistan programs of the 1980s. You know, when the Mujahideen was fighting the Soviets, Al-Qaeda has deep connections to the Saudis and to the ISI in Pakistan. And a lot of the hijackers have connections to the ISI as well. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the mastermind. He's known to have worked for the ISI. Syed Sheikh, the 9/11 paymaster, was an ISI agent. And the President Musharraf has a book that says that Syed Sheikh was also an MI6 agent, according to the president. I don't know. But in any case, Syed Sheikh reportedly wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta just before the 9/11 attacks and at the direction of the ISI Chief General Ahmed.
So
it looks very much like the Pakistan's ISI was involved.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the U.S. government was.
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah, okay. So Michael Shermer, you're
yeah, asking. this is interesting. This is not quite the direction I thought we were going to go, but that's okay. I mean, let's be realistic here. American foreign policy since Kissinger has always been this realpolitik where we get into bed with dictators all the time. It's the question of, as Lyndon Johnson said, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we do these kinds of things, and it's one of the reasons that, you know, presidents that don't want to do that, that want to hold by strict moral principles are criticized, that, you know, you have to live in the real world, and we have to fund this dictator because he's better than that communist guy or whatever it is. So, yeah, no doubt, there's been a lot of government underhanding things in the Middle East because it's such a complex mess. But that's still different than saying that they intended to bring down the World Trade Center.
Right. So let's get into why people should be skeptical of the 9/11 Commission report or not. Maybe why, you know, alternatively, why people should think that this was the last word on it. And what really happened? What really happened on that day? And in the second half hour of our program, we'll drop in a few calls from our listeners. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Anybody here see the noise, see the fear and commotion? I think we missed it.
No, we're not missing it here. What happened on 9/11? Kevin Ryan is with us from the Journal of 9/11Studies.com. Take out the thought. It's Journal of 9/11Studies.com, co-editor of that journal. And Michael Shermer with Skeptic Magazine, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, executive director of the Skeptic Society, Skeptic.com. I want to get into the inflammatory meat and potatoes stuff here. 9/11 Commission got it all wrong. Building 7 was controlled demolition. What about these things that hit the Pentagon? What happened to all the videotapes? Why did they smuggle away all the evidence? Why did Rudy Giuliani suspend the rescue operations as soon as he had the gold out of the bottom of the World Trade Center? Probably that's more, you know, self-evident. Anyhow, let's start with you, Kevin. Why should we be skeptical of the 9/11 Commission report?
Well, for a couple of very important reasons. They left out so many important facts of their report, and they had a lot of conflicts of interest, and also they just uncritically accepted accounts from government officials. So they left out just a gigantic number of facts. All the conflicts of interest of the Philip Zelikow, the executive director, for example, who's a Bush insider and really controlled the investigation. Any mention of World Trade Center 7, the third skyscraper that supposedly collapsed despite not being hit by a plane. The fact that President Bush's relatives were in charge of the security company for the World Trade Center, United Airlines, and Dulles Airport.
That was in the past, though, wasn't it?
Actually, it was in 1999 through 2000 for Marvin Bush, but Wirt Walker, his cousin, was CEO at the time that the attacks occurred. So, yeah, and I mean, there are a lot of FBI agents who reportedly claim to have known the targets and the dates of the attacks well in advance, and their testimony was not included. There was news stories suggesting after 9/11 that the U.S. military allowed Osama bin Laden to escape. Just the fact that the Bush and the bin Laden families are all business partners might have been something you could put in that report.
George Sr. was having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother on the morning of 9/11. It was
right.
I believe that was in the New York Times. So a lot of questions here, Kevin. You're asserting that all of these questions point to conspiracy.
Well, no, I'm saying that we have a conspiracy no matter what, but of the two hypotheses, the one that the evidence supports most strongly is that there were government agencies involved in the attacks. We can't prove either one way or another.
What about rogues within the government? People who...
Absolutely.
You know, like with the Kennedy assassination, I mean, you know, E. Howard Hunt was part of the CIA, but that doesn't mean that the CIA had anything to do with it if he did.
Sure, and if you just ask a simple question like who is responsible for in charge of defending the country when it was under attack and what did those people do on 9/11, we find out that everybody in that chain of command was either mysteriously absent or completely incompetent during just that period of the attacks. I mean, Bush was reading My Pet Goat, right? The next person was Donald Rumsfeld, and the commission says he did not enter the chain of command until the morning's events were over. And then the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Henry Shelton, was flying to London, and his replacement was in a meeting. And General Montague Winfield of the NMCC, believe it or not, asked his deputy to take over for just the 2 hours of the day of the attack. This poor Captain Leidig, who replaced him for just those 2 hours, turned out to be incompetent. And then NORAD's General Eberhardt was indisposed because he was driving around on Cheyenne Mountain.
Now, so, is all of this or is none of this in the 9/11 report, Kevin?
Really, none of this is clarified in the... Well, obviously, the president was indisposed. He was in this elementary school.
But most of the stuff that you're raising that really raises eyebrows, you're suggesting is not in the 9/11 report. I mean, I've skimmed the thing, but I haven't read every word. Michael Shermer, your response, Michael Shermer of Skeptic.com.
Yeah. Well, just for fun here while we were talking, I typed into Google Video building demolition, and there are no less than 2,200 videos of buildings that collapse due to intentional demolition.
Right.
And every one of them, I haven't found one exception yet, collapses from the bottom up. And yet the World Trade Center buildings collapsed from the top down, not quite the top, right where the airplanes impacted. So are we to believe that the Bush administration orchestrated the intentional demolition of the World Trade Center buildings, planted all those bombs without anybody demolition devices without anybody catching them, and then managed to place the bombs in just such a way that they would start exploding right where the plane happened to hit, so they'd have to know where the planes were going to hit and time all that? Are we really supposed to believe
Kevin,
that?
Kevin, is that possible?
Well, there's a great deal of assumptions here. Michael's already worked out how many people. He said thousands of operatives would be needed. Let's not get away from ourselves here. We've got a couple of hypotheses. We've got evidence. We don't need to speculate to the point of distraction. Let's consider where the towers first failed, though. We know the North Tower.
We have to take a break in about 10 seconds, 15
okay,
seconds.
All right.
But first of all, collapsing from the top down versus the bottom up.
No, there are examples of buildings being demolished from the top down. I'd go to 911blogger.com. You can find an example there.
Okay. Well, okay. We'll continue this conversation between Michael Shermer of Skeptic.com and Kevin Ryan, Journal of 911studies.com. Maybe drop a few calls in here as we go through. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome and listen in to a radio station with a mighty host, a living sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. turn your radio on.
Yeah, here we are on the radio. And who did 9/11, how and why? We're talking with Kevin Ryan, Journal of 9/11Studies.com, co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and Michael Shermer of the Skeptic magazine, Skeptic.com, executive director of the Skeptics Society. And let's see, Kevin, you had just gone through a long list of some very serious questions. Michael, your response.
Oh, well, I guess the other thing I was going to add about, you know, in terms of how the buildings collapse and all that and the assumptions we make, there's also a cognitive problem here. It's called the hindsight bias. It is after a big event like this, people start combing through the details of the event, the records of what happened in the months leading up to it. And Pearl Harbor is a perfect example. There were, for many years, lots of conspiracy theories about how Roosevelt knew about it or
still is
orchestrated it, or Churchill and Roosevelt together.
There are still people who believe
it. For one, just like one specific example where we see, like, with the memo that Condi Rice got in August about Al-Qaeda attacking the United States on United States soil, why didn't we heed that warning? Well, there's actually lots of memos about Al-Qaeda doing all sorts of things all over the world, and of course after the event it's easy to go with hindsight and pick out the one that mattered. And the same thing with the Pearl Harbor attack. There were definitely memos that the U.S. government had about the Japanese possibly attacking Pearl Harbor. It's easy to pick those out and ignore the hundreds of others about the Japanese attacking in other places, because after the event, after the fact, you go through and you reconstruct a causal chain that points right to that event, and then hold those accountable who should have seen that chain coming, when in fact, we at the time, you don't know what's going to happen.
Okay. Kevin Ryan from the Journal of 9/11Studies.com. Talk to us about Building 7.
All right, well, Building 7 was a 47-story building that was not hit by a plane, and yet it collapsed in 6.5 seconds, essentially free fall speed, and pretty much into its own footprint. And more than 6 years later, we're still waiting for an official explanation about it. And in 2002, FEMA gave us a really low probability suggestion, they said, and NIST has continued to push their report out. But it's important to know that no building has ever collapsed from fire before or after 9/11, and no building exhibiting all the features of demolition has ever not been a demolition. So speaking of probabilities, the chance that the first three examples of fire-induced collapse of a tall building happening all on the same day is infinitesimal. So I think it's a good point for us to be skeptical about, especially considering the 9/11 Commission didn't mention it in their supposedly comprehensive report.
Here's the question that I can't get my head around, Kevin. And let me, Michael, if I may, just I suspect this is something that you might say, so I'll say it. The flying of the planes into these two buildings was plenty. Why would anybody have to go in and put in explosives on top of that? I mean, you know, that was enough to give George Bush everything
sure.
he needed to declare, you know, to that's his Reichstag fire. That's,
well,
you know.
You know, I'm not sure, Tom. You have to consider what the alternative hypothesis means. And I think David Ray Griffin put it well when he said, whoever controls the world's oil controls the world. So this is not just.
You said
another,
that on this program 2 years ago.
This is not just another government-sponsored false flag event like the Gulf of Tonkin or many others, but it's more of a psychological operation aimed at a large audience. So
but again, why bring down the buildings? I mean, that was the planes were enough to
right.
horrify.
They
us.
Needed people to be in front of the TV. Is what it looks like. So you know, the building, if the buildings are rigged for demolition, it doesn't matter. When, you know, there's a demolition team there. It doesn't matter where the buildings are hit. They're rigged for demolition. And, you know, if you wait an hour or so until everybody's in front of the TV, then the psychological effect is there. And that's what drives the emotionally driven 9/11 wars. You know, if something had just happened to a building, I mean, something happened to a building before. The embassies in Africa were blown up, right?
Well, the World Trade Center was blown up. It just didn't.
The World Trade Center was
1993.
Blown up. The Oklahoma City building was blown up. Lots of buildings have been blown up. They didn't result in generating endless wars that are supposed to protect us from terrorism, which is an oxymoron to begin with. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So what makes sense is that those people with the power to make this happen, to allow an effective stand down of our air defenses, to allow these hijackers to get lucky at every single turn, to essentially have access to and the means to bring those buildings down. Those are the people who, it seems, are much more likely to have affected the crimes.
Michael Shermer.
Well, Tom, I think your point is well taken. It wouldn't have mattered really what happened to the full extent on 9/11. We'd be in a war. I mean, I think you can legitimately criticize the Bush administration for all of its steps along the way and even its motives without any of this 9/11 conspiracy stuff going on, because that's just sort of the way politics works. And
what about the security standing down? What about ignoring
let's look at the specific points. If you watch the videos of the World Trade Center buildings collapsing, they both collapse right at the point where the planes hit.
No, actually, that's
where they begin.
We
can all watch it. Let's all go online.
Sure.
And watch it right now.
Let's do
that's
it.
Where they collapse.
Well, hang on just a second, Michael. Kevin wants to contest
that.
It's
actually not true at all. If we look at the North Tower, the first thing that happens is this antenna on the top drops first. That means the core of the building failed first. And additionally, on the South Tower, the first thing that happened is this large upper section starts to tilt over, and it's got kinks all along the top of it. So it fails in multiple spots, even away from the fire. But again, even if the collapse was to start, or the destruction was to start right at the point of impact, if the buildings are rigged for demolition, what does it matter?
Okay, Michael, I'm sorry I interrupted you mid-sentence, but I wanted
again,
that point to get resolved.
When you say they did it, who in the world are we talking about here? Where are all these people? Why have they not come forward? Are they murdered? Are they kept silent? Again, back to my first point. Look what happens to all these people, like Plame, what's her name?
Valerie.
Yeah, Valerie Plame. Look, she's got a book contract out there. I mean, this is what people do once they leave government. I mean, there's the two.
But Valerie Plame is not running around bragging that she helped murder 3,000 people.
Yeah, well, right.
I mean, who's going to do that?
Well, no, you wouldn't need somebody who actually did it. Just imagine all the people that would have to be running around. It's now been estimated there would be 60 tons of explosives to bring down the World Trade Center.
Not at all. Not at all.
So where are those? And where are the explosives? How come all the people combing through the wreckage didn't find anything? Not one little piece of evidence for that.
No,
where
no.
is all that?
Kevin?
You've got really a lot of false speculation going on there. The Landmark Hotel was brought down with about 450 pounds of explosives. It's 30 stories tall. And so the World Trade Center, if you extrapolate that, would have required about 1,300 pounds of explosives. That's about 30 trips, 10 people in 3 trips. It's not that difficult to believe at all. And, of course,
speculating is one thing, but where's the evidence that is actually what happened?
Well, see, the evidence that demolition happened is about the effects, right? The sudden onset, the symmetrical and vertical fall, the near free fall speed. These are things that just can't happen in a fire-induced collapse, and we've really tried to prove. I mean, if the government has done anything, they've really tried to prove this fire-induced collapse hypothesis, and they've failed, and in fact proved it wrong through contradiction. They've tried so many things, and we found that the only thing we have left, which they never looked at, is the demolition hypothesis. And so, really, I think
The World Trade Center Building 7 does not collapse in a straight down to its footprint. It collapses at the point where the debris hit on the south side. If you look at the photos of the north side, it looks clean and fairly pristine. You can't believe it would have collapsed from that. But if you look on the photos on the south side, it burnt extensively
for
many hours.
Michael, if you have photos on the south side of the World Trade Center 7, you need to get those to the government. I don't believe they have any. And so far, I don't believe they've been published. So what really happened, if you look at the movie clip, this building collapses more perfectly than a perfect demolition. It comes down straight down. And uniformly down. It doesn't lean towards any damage. And really the only damage, again, that's speculation on the part of those supporting the official story, is supposedly.
But Kevin, let me just toss a,
sure.
I got it. If you really wanted to create psychological chaos and mass mayhem, why not have the buildings fall over sideways, take out 10 other buildings with them, and kill 20,000-30,000 people rather than 3,000? Then you really have a 9/11 or a Pearl Harbor.
I tell you what, that's possible. I don't know why the reasoning for whoever did it, why they did it in the exact way. But again, the hypotheses don't need to be proven. We need to look at the evidence and pick which of them is best suited to be accepted or rejected. And so, you know, to speculate on all the different things that would have had to happen, like Michael has done, he knows exactly how many people would be needed. He knows exactly how many explosives, and that turns out to be wrong. It's very unskeptical.
Let me give you an analogy. Last April, there was a crash in an underpass under a bridge in Oakland. A tanker truck crashed into a bridge. It caused this huge gasoline fire, and the bridge collapsed. Now, why is nobody getting all excited about somebody intentionally demolishing this bridge? Well, because things collapse if they burn long enough. You don't have to completely melt steel. You only have to weaken it. And that's what happened with the World Trade Center building.
Well,
so I think we've hashed this one out. I'd like to move, because we have very little time here. We're going to have to take a break in about a minute, and then we'll only have 6 or 7 minutes when we resolve this. And I apologize to the people waiting on hold, but I just want to get as much as I can out of you guys. Let's talk to how it came to be that these planes hit these buildings and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. Kevin, your best thought on how this came about.
That is a great question, because, you know, the airspace over Washington is restricted, and it's considered the most heavily defended on the planet. It even has a name. It's called P-56B, a 3-mile inter-restricted zone over the White House, Capitol, and the Pentagon. So, you know, we've got... also, Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta telling us that the Vice President was warned every 10 or 20 miles as this plane was coming in, that it was coming in, and he said that the orders should still stand. He told this young man telling him that. So it's interesting that Norman Mineta's testimony didn't get into the 9/11 Commission report, but it is clear that we had noticed that the Pentagon was going to be struck.
Okay, we'll continue with this conversation right after the break. Kevin Ryan, Journal of 9/11Studies.com, Michael Shermer, Skeptic.com, 46 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, our quote for the day from Winston Churchill: the truth is incontrovertible. Malice may attack it, ignorance may deride it, but in the end, there it is. So what is the truth regarding 9/11? Michael Shermer, Skeptic Magazine: why is it that Osama bin Laden isn't on the FBI's most wanted list, has never been charged with 9/11?
I have no idea. I have to ask the government that. I mean, why are we spending billions of dollars trying to find him if we don't want him? What difference does it make whether he's on the list or not? I don't think the FBI is going to find him because they're not in Afghanistan. They're here.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. I mean, otherwise, I mean, you can argue we're in Iraq for oil, but why would we be in Afghanistan other than just trying to dismantle al-Qaeda?
Well, you could argue that Hamid Karzai used to be a consultant for UNICAL, and UNICAL wanted to build a gas pipeline across Afghanistan, et cetera. But that's getting, I think, a little away. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know.
Well, I think they were trying to connect too many dots there. Again, back to the economy of causality, I think Occam's razor, the simpler explanation. 19 guys can get away with it. Hundreds would most likely be caught, or eventually something would come out. We really have nothing. All of these arguments are, like in creationist circles, we call these the God of the gaps. Wherever you guys can't explain X, that must be where the supernatural entity came in to do something.
So,
wherever the government can't explain something, that must mean there's a conspiracy. Well, it's possible that maybe we just can't explain it yet.
Right, and sometimes there actually is a conspiracy. So, Kevin Ryan, again, I'm trying to play independent broker here, but Kevin, how small a conspiracy to, at the very least, allow this to happen could there be? And you know, because I hear conspiracy theories that, you know, well, it really, you know, Bush really didn't know where or when they were going to hit. He knew it was going to happen probably in August or September, and he knew it was probably going to happen in New York or Washington, D.C., and he wanted it to happen, and so they stood all the way up to, you know, right down to, well, they had control systems in the Building 7 that flew the planes into the towers, and that's why they had to, I mean, you know, there's this whole spectrum of, but how small a group could it have been?
Well, I think that there could have been a relatively small group based on a military sort of operation, a compartmentalized operation. I'm not an expert on those sorts of things, but as far as whistleblowers go, we do know there's been a lot of whistleblowers related to 9/11. I mean, there were FBI agents trying to contact John Ashcroft for the 6 weeks before 9/11 to give him exact details, and he wouldn't return their calls. We've got Sybil Edmonds, the FBI whistleblower, who told us they haven't even mentioned anybody who was actually connected to Al-Qaeda in a mid or higher level. So the 9/11 Commission isn't even addressing the issue of Al-Qaeda. We've got Jersey girl Patty Casazza, who recently said that whistleblowers told her before 9/11 that the government knew the day, the type of attack, and the targets. So there's a lot of whistleblowers out there. That's not the question. The question is, why aren't people finding out about this? For example, World Trade Center 7 is a great example. A lot of people still don't know about that. It's no secret. You know, it's no secret that that building collapsed. So I think there are plenty of whistleblowers. There's plenty of a chance for the truth to yet come out.
So Michael Shermer, Skeptic.com, what about the stock options, these puts that were made before 9/11, you know, betting on the collapse of United and American Airlines? You know, you've got that. You've got all these whistleblowers. You've got, you know, over 50 specific warnings to the Bush administration.
Well, again, with the hindsight bias, we pick out anomalies, we connect the dots in some.
But that's what you do
way.
In a criminal investigation.
But if there was so much activity ahead of time, why didn't we know about it? Why didn't somebody do something about this? Because surely not everybody's going to be in on the conspiracy.
Well, it certainly seems to have worked out very well for the Bush administration.
Well, has it? I mean, they're
yeah,
like
they got their wars.
All-time lowest ratings of a president.
I don't think he expected the war in Iraq to go south like that. But you know, Halliburton stock is four times what it was. Dick Cheney has made millions and millions of dollars off this. The Bush family and Bechtel have made billions of dollars off this thing.
Yeah,
and continue to.
But you don't need a conspiracy for that. That's just good old American politics and business, right? I mean,
you think that's opportunity?
That happened in the Vietnam War. That doesn't mean
yeah, Lady Bird Johnson.
Well,
you know, we've got a conspiracy. Again, we've got a conspiracy no matter how you look at it. So the conspiracy theory term is just a derogatory term to try and turn people's minds away from looking at the evidence. But I think that, you know, there's plenty of opportunity for the government, certain elements within the government, to have not only accomplished the attacks of 9/11 much more easily than 19 fellows.
How about the suicide boat bombing against the USS Cole in 2000?
How about it?
Yeah, I mean, do you think the U.S. government did that to its own ship?
Let me just pause this. We have 30 seconds before we have to wrap this up. I'm going to give each of you 15 seconds to wrap it up. So, Kevin Ryan, 15 seconds.
Hey, well, I think that the evidence that we have on hand points to the need to accept the alternative hypothesis. And, you know, skeptics, natural skeptics, would be looking at that official hypothesis very closely and also at the evidence for the alternative.
And Michael Shermer?
Well, because I think it's legitimate to criticize the Bush administration for this whole business, this is only a distraction away from that because it's so far out there. Al-Qaeda said they did it. They'd do it again. They were proud that they did it, and I think we should take them at their word for it.
Okay, Michael Shermer, Skeptic.com, Kevin Ryan, Journal of 9/11, 911, Studies.com. Gentlemen, both of you, thank you so much for coming on the program and talking with each other and with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Much appreciated. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program here on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. We've got a whole lot of callers on this topic at 20 after the hour. Christy Harvey is going to be dropping by to talk about what's the news under the radar. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to have Isaiah Poole from TomPaine.com and Rob Call from OpEdNews.com, our blogger segment. And at 45 minutes past the hour, we've got a correspondent from Talk Radio News calling in from, is it Pakistan, I believe? Or Afghanistan, in any case, from someplace in the Middle East, is going to be calling into calling into the program. So I'm going to take calls right, and we also have our segment, our weekly segment, where we bring on a local advertiser who's doing really well with Progressive Talk Radio on a local station, and we want to highlight them. We're going to do that in this first segment. So I'm going to take a couple of calls here. We'll get the advertiser in, and then we're going to be going to everything else. So the bottom line of all this, the reason I tell you all this, is to please be very brief. Robert, Daly City, California.
Tom, thanks so much for having Kevin Ryan, and he's very intelligent, moral, and even-minded. And
I agree with you. They're both great people, Rob. Robert, make your point, please, because I need to move along to other people as quickly as I can.
Yeah, well, Richard B. Cheney was running the U.S. Air Force training exercises on 9/11, and he's the guy that hijacked the U.S. Air Force training exercises, and an investigation will prove that.
Yeah, okay, great. I have heard that before, and I would love to see an investigation of this. Mike and Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Mike.
Hi, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for having me.
Good point.
How to talk to people who put down truthers. I think specifically if you focus on the missing Pentagon videos, we are a very video-oriented society. If a car ran into a mini-mart, their surveillance footage would be across the nation that night.
Where are the Pentagon surveillance videos? Good point, Mike. Thank you very much. Josh in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry. I just don't buy into this grand conspiracy theory that Bush was behind 9/11.
There's dozens of different possibilities, and one of them is that he had nothing to do with it, and yet still there was a conspiracy here within the United States. Or it could be that the level of his conspiracy was simply, okay, I've been warned that these guys are going to hit, and I can make political hay out of this, so I'm going to go to sleep for 6 months. I mean, he took the longest vacation in the history of the United States presidency, and even at the end of his vacation, he was afraid to go back to Washington D.C. He went to Florida instead, where his brother put the whole state on a state of emergency.
I agree with you. It does seem like that, but I think if there is a conspiracy by the Bush administration, it was that they took advantage of 9/11. I don't think that they.
You don't think that they caused it. Josh, good, you know, thank you very much, and excellent point. And as I said, my mind is not made up. I'm trying to keep an open mind here. We need a real investigation. Josephine in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Josephine.
Hey, thank you, Tom. So good to be on your show. Listen, we just had something recently that happened. We had on August 29th, we had 6 nuclear bombs fly across this country.
Right, down to Barksdale Air Force Base.
That's right, and nobody knows what happened. Nobody's taking any responsibility.
Well, actually, I think about 60 people lost their jobs over that, and people got busted down in rank. There was a news story about that. Assuming that's true, I mean, one never knows with the Pentagon whether there's, you know, CYA going on inside or whether it's public publicity. But yeah, good point, Josephine. And frankly, I can give you a long list of historical conspiracies going all the way back to the Civil War that were kept secret for more than 40 years. Lisa in South Carolina.
Hello. I would like to know why they only limit it to 2 hypotheses, and why not look at the physical evidence?
Well, I think that's what we were trying to do, is to say there's more than just 2 possibilities, two hypotheses here.
And where did the material go? There's no material there. The guys they rescued out of Stairwell B, when they came out, they said it was like walking onto an empty football field. That's not like any controlled demolition I've ever seen.
Well, that's an interesting one. Thank you, Lisa. Yeah, and all the steel got shipped off, as I recall, to Korea to be melted down, strangely enough. Abby in San Diego, California. Hey, Abby.
Hi, thank you. Well, one thing Kevin didn't mention was the plethora of evidence for controlled demolition, including the molten metal. We see thermite dripping out of the tower before it collapses. Thermite, Stephen Jones, he's a physics professor from BYU. He did forensic testing on the steel, found thermite, which is an explosive incendiary in the military. Hundreds of eyewitness accounts of explosives. Firefighters, emergency responders, William Rodriguez, who's a janitor in the World Trade Center for 20 years, now he spends his life dedicated to spreading the truth, spreading the information that there were explosives. He heard explosives in the sub-basement before the towers were even hit. The free fall speed of both towers, the pulverization of concrete. Wake up, guys. Visit AE911truth.org. hundreds of architects and engineers who are signing on for a new investigation because
right.
they've looked at this evidence.
Yeah, I've seen their video. Thank you, Abby. And it's a fascinating site. Bernard in Los Angeles. Hey, Bernard.
Hi, this is Bruno.
Bruno, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree with Abby. Just the videos of the buildings themselves coming down is the evidence. And both towers came down in the exact same way. And this idea, and then Michael.
Couldn't that just have been, incompetent design or intentional design so that if the buildings were ever compromised, they wouldn't hurt, they would hurt as few people as possible?
No, all that steel, you think there's a massive steel grid wrapped around each tower, and there's 47 massive steel columns in the core of the tower, and you think all that steel snapped simultaneously, floor by floor, 110 floors in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
That's preposterous.
Okay.
And Michael from Skeptics Magazine offered no evidence to support anything about the official story. I mean,
I got it, Bernard. Thank you very much. And I don't disagree. Katie in Los Angeles, just a very quick one, Katie, and then we've got to go to Tony Parsons.
Okay, I'm from WeAreChangeLA.org. We did the Bill Maher infiltration. We have a truth march and street actions this Sunday, November 11th at 11 a.m. in Santa Monica. Go to WeAreChangeLA.org. It's at Colorado and Ocean Ave at the bluff at the top of the Santa Monica Pier.
Got it. Thank you very much, Katie, and thanks for coming on and sharing that, and good luck with your demonstration. Tony Parsons is with us. Tony is the owner and operator of Signature Cafe and Catering Company. Signaturecafe.net is the website. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
How are you doing today, Tom?
Just great. You're in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I have had dinner in your cafe. It is absolutely wonderful. You advertise on our local affiliate, KTNF, in Minnesota, AM 950, Air America, Minnesota. What's happening? What kind of results are you getting? What's up?
Well, my wife, Natalie Johnson, and I, co-owners, I basically work for her, of course, and we've been advertising with Janet Robert, owner of AM 950 here in Minneapolis, for a little over 3 years, and we've had just incredible results. We are a little more able to track that being in the restaurant. Most of our customers will come in and say, we're here because we hear your ads on AM 950, and listen to Air America. Love your program and all the other programs that are offered. And we think that we've found a great niche just with the demographics that we have in our restaurant.
So progressive advertising on local progressive talk radio is working for your restaurant, Tony.
Oh, absolutely. We saw the first year we increased probably 180%, I believe we tracked. And each year it's progressively actually gone higher. And we feel that we've just tapped into the perfect marketplace.
How does this compare with other forms of advertising that you've used in the past?
We've done a few local neighborhood. We try to keep things locally and in our neighborhood as far as newspaper ads and a couple that also offer online ads. And, you know, we do get some things back from that. It's just not as visible, and people aren't as likely to let us know that we did see your ad in a newspaper compared to hearing it on the radio.
Yeah.
And we've had other area radio stations call once they heard that we were on AM 950, and we basically say, well, how do your numbers stack up during these times of the day against the programming on AM 950? And their numbers didn't come close, so we couldn't justify being with any other radio station than a progressive radio station.
Yeah. So the bottom line is Progressive Talk Radio is working for the Signature Cafe in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on AM 950 KTNF, a great station, and Tony Parsons. And let me encourage everybody and all of our listeners in Minneapolis to get down to the Signature Cafe and check out their fabulous food, signaturecafe.net. Tony Parsons, thanks for being with us, Tony, and sharing your story with us.
Appreciate it, Tom, and we hope to see you again here soon in the Twin Cities. We love you here.
I think I'll be there within a month or two, so
great.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Bye now.
Crockett in Iowa City, Iowa. We have about a half a minute here to wrap up this segment. Crockett, you're on the air. Crockett is not there. John in Sunnyvale, California. John, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Has anyone looked into the ownership of the World Trade Center? It had been sold to a private owner partnership in mid-2001, having been built and managed by the Port Authority as a public resource. And then in the negotiations for the...
So it was built publicly and then privatized?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And then it was in the negotiations for the building, they got a insurance coverage that would provide coverage for terrorist bombing.
Which may or may not be unusual, right?
Well, if it was terror, if it was, you know, most...
You think it was unusual. John, I'm sorry we're out of time, but you got your point out, and I appreciate the call. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
No offense in dancing around the subject. A wound gets worse when it's treated with neglect. Well, don't turn now. There's nothing here to fear.
Yeah, let's talk about what's going on in the world today. Let's talk about, in particular, what's going on that might be flying under the radar. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and does the daily news prep site MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org, of course, the website for the Center for American Progress. One of the smartest people in the world on this kind of stuff, and one of my favorites. Christy, welcome to the program.
One of the smartest people in the world? I love that. Why, thank you.
You're brilliant. You really and truly are. Okay, so a few things you were telling me about. This is just incredible. FEMA? Tell me about this.
Heck of a job, yeah. Okay, so we found out last year, obviously, that FEMA had put families whose homes were destroyed during Hurricane Katrina into these toxic trailers that were filled with formaldehyde fumes.
Right, we're talking about well over 10,000 families, aren't we?
Exactly. And they first discovered it because first everybody's pets started to die, then their kids started to get really sick, and then FEMA found out about it and covered it up and wouldn't let anybody know about it. It finally broke in the news.
But they kept the families in them.
The families are still living in these trailers. And they haven't replaced them. They haven't done anything to, you know, make it less toxic. But the one thing that they have done is yesterday they put out a directive. And FEMA has now prohibited its own staff members from stepping inside, even briefly, these trailers because it's just too dangerous. So poor families can live in them. That's cool. But FEMA officers
cannot even walk inside and take a breath.
They kind of can't even look at them. They're so dangerous. They have been told to just completely avoid these trailers because they are toxic.
That is mind-boggling. You have been keeping an eye on the Minutemen.
I have, and this is interesting. I love when bad people get what's coming to them. And the Minutemen, 2 years ago, they had this big thing. These are those hateful vigilante guys who've decided to patrol the border between U.S. and Mexico to keep Mexicans from coming in.
Yeah.
And so
the brown people are coming!
Here they come, exactly. Yeah. So 2 years ago, their founder, a lovely guy named Chris Simcox.
Who actually has been a guest on this program.
You've talked to him in
yes.
real life?
Yeah,
wow.
Twice, actually. He actually comes across as a very reasonable and nice guy. I threw the thing at him, you know, hey, you're acting like a bigot and a racist.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. We've got a bunch of Hispanic members. And which I thought was really interesting. But in any case,
wait till you hear what he's done. I hope
okay.
I change your mind a little bit here.
Yeah.
So he 2 years ago announced he was going to build the Mac Daddy of all fences. It was going to be 14 feet tall, razor wire, facial recognition cameras, you know, the entire border, yada, yada, yada. And so he started raising money. And the xenophobic dollars started to pour in. Some guy they talked about, you know, mortgaged his house so he could give $100,000 to Chris Simcox for this fence. I hope that guy wasn't married, but can you imagine? Honey! So CNN this week decided to follow up and see how the fence is going.
Mm.
And the fence is a few feet long, and it is, you know, about shoulder height,
mm-hmm.
and it's some sticks with some barbed wire between them. And they looked at it and they said, oh my goodness, he built a cow fence. And
yeah.
it is a fence, and the guy whose property he built it on said, I love it. It keeps the Mexican cows from actually mingling in with my cows. And I guess that had been a problem on the border of this guy's ranch. And that's it. And no one knows where the money went. And Chris Simcox ain't talking.
Well, if they can maybe find one illegal immigrant who wants to come into the country and just, you know, they need to point big arrows to that fence and say,
right.
Okay, here's where you try to go so that we can stop you, so that we can claim success. Yeah, I've, you know, when Chris was on the program, he wasn't here as my guest so that we could be buddies. He was one of the people, I have conservatives on that I debate almost every day.
And I love it.
That
yeah.
was the context. He came on and we had a food fight on the air twice. But in any case, that's fascinating. Time Magazine is thinking about Man of the Year. What
yes.
do you know about that?
And, yeah, they always announce that, you know, beginning of December. And last year it was all of us, you know, I won, actually, Time Magazine Person of the Year. It was you.
Mm,
but.
Which I thought was.
It's kind of lame.
Yeah, very lame.
But it's fun to brag, you know, hey, I was 2006, Time Magazine Woman of the Year. But this year they haven't announced, but they're having an online poll so readers can vote for who they'd like their Time Magazine Person of the Year to be. And so I checked it out to see what the breakdown was, and by far, the number one hit right now is Vice President Al Gore.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
By far and away, everybody else.
And finally, Jerome Corsi, and we were trying to get him on this program to talk about this, and he's been on the program a number of times as well. We have knockdown dragouts. And he's suing Eagle Publishing in a way that may reveal how right-wingers get their books on the New York Times bestseller list when, in fact, nobody's actually buying them.
Absolutely, yeah. There's five really right-wing authors who are suing Eagle Publishing and the very right-wing branch of that, which is the their smaller publishing house, because they're saying that they aren't making enough money. They're upset that the publishing company is out for profit, which I think is fabulous for conservatives to be mad that somebody's making a profit on them. Because they say that the publishing company sells their books at a discount to conservative book clubs.
Right. They basically give the books away so that they can get enough of them out in print so that the New York Times will say, hey, it's a New York Times bestseller.
Right.
When in fact, nobody's actually going into a bookstore and saying, I'd like to buy this book. And this is how these guys from Jerome Corsi to Ann Coulter get on the list. It's amazing. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Let's take a look at the news here. First, just a quick heads up. My new book, Cracking the Code, is available at a 35% discount at Powell's bookstores and online nationwide at their website, powells.com. There's an S at the end. Tomorrow, I'll be doing the show live from Phoenix, from KPHX. And tomorrow afternoon, 3 to 5 in Phoenix at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills, we'll be doing a gig on the book, on Cracking the Code. And you need tickets for that. That's at 1480kphx.com to pick up the tickets. On the 12th, on Monday, I'll be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'll be doing my show live from New York, from the Air America studios there. And that evening in Philadelphia, we'll be at the White Dog Cafe, 6 p.m. dinner, 7:30 Cracking the Code on Sampson Street. On the 13th, the evening of the 13th at the Strand Bookstore, Richard Belzer will be introducing me, and I'll be doing a riff, or whatever you want to call it, on Cracking the Code, followed by a book signing. That'll be at 7 p.m. at the Strand on Tuesday in New York City in Manhattan. On Wednesday, the 14th in New York City, at Demos, the Network for Ideas in Action, I believe Mark Green is going to show up and introduce me. That'll be great to see him. And that'll be at Demos at 5:30. And then on the 16th, Green960. .com in San Francisco. You need, again, to go there to get tickets. Little Fox Theater in Redwood City, 3:30 in the afternoon, after we do the show live from San Francisco, from our San Francisco affiliate. And on the 17th, in conjunction with KRXA, our affiliate in Monterey, I'll be at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California. And so I look forward to seeing you at one of those places. With us now, let's go out and check out the tubes, not the trucks, as Senator Stevens is wont to remind us, the internets, and find out what's going on, what's on the top of people's minds, and what's coming up. Isaiah Poole is with us. He's with TomPaine.com, the executive editor of TomPaine.com. Hey, Isaiah, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Rob Call, Op-Ed News. He's the publisher and senior editor of OpEdNews.com. And Rob, in addition to thanks for being with us, my apologies for last night. I was just, really, really grumpy, and I'm sorry that We had a phone
I thought you sounded more fried than grumpy.
Yeah, that's the word. I was. It was one hell of a long day yesterday, and I shouldn't have waited until the end of the day to give you a call because you're an old friend, and it's I apologize. Right here on
no
the air.
No problem.
So, anyhow, great to have you both on. Isaiah, over at TomPaine.com, what are you seeing as the biggest, biggest stories of the day, the week, you know, what's going on?
Well, we're actually getting a lot of, I'm scanning our blog now, and we're getting a lot of comment about a couple of pieces. We've been, on our blog, we've been writing a lot about, the continuing manifestation of E. coli conservatism, the toy, recall mm-hmm. issue.
E. coli conservatism being the frame that you're using to suggest that when the conservatives strip away regulatory systems and do away with government, as Reagan suggested, then we end up with poisoned food and poisoned toys and poisoned everything.
And the latest, of course, is that we've got these balls, and I forget what they're called, but these sort of toy balls, if you put them in your mouth, you end up with the date rape drug chemical in your mouth. And we actually link to a story of a parent whose child ingested one of these balls that were they're made in China. They're distributed by an Australian firm. And
now these are play balls. These are not like candy that you eat. Balls of candy.
No. And the fascinating thing about it is that the chemical that's involved is used as a glue. Now, and it's also not. It's classified as a toxic chemical. The glue that is supposed to be used, though, by the company that makes this, happens to be four times more expensive than the chemical that they actually used.
Right. So, of course, they use the cheap stuff, which also happens to be the date rape. That's interesting also that the date rape drug is also a glue and is also a toxic chemical. I mean, this is interesting on multiple levels.
Right.
Interesting. Thank you, Isaiah. Rob Call over at opednews.com. What are you seeing as the biggest story of the day?
Well, there's a story in the Wall Street Journal in the back of it that the military has blocked a Marine attorney from testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. He actually made a decision not to prosecute somebody who was accused of terrorism and involvement in some pretty serious terrorist acts because he was tortured. Because the torture made his testimony invalid.
It tainted the testimony. So we have a Marine, I'm assuming a JAG officer, a Marine lawyer,
yes.
A Marine prosecutor who chose not to prosecute presumably an Afghan or Iraqi or something like that, you know, some Middle Eastern person, not one of our soldiers, but somebody who was one of the, quote, as Bush would say it, the bad guys, who chose not to prosecute this guy because the evidence that would have been used for his prosecution included a confession obtained under torture. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, now, that's the back story. The front story is the military is refusing to allow him to testify. They're basically treating him like they're treating Bush's advisors, saying he can't testify. They're blocking him from responding to the subpoena.
To Congress. So they're saying this Marine officer who made the decision not to prosecute a guy because his testimony was obtained under torture is now being prevented by the administration from testifying to Congress about his unwillingness to prosecute somebody over a torture obtained confession. Is that right?
Exactly. And, you know, I can see Bush's hand behind this. And I can see Bush saying you can't talk to my lawyer. But for him to try to extend it this far, if Congress doesn't totally get on top of this, then they're giving up a major portion of their power that maintains the balance of power. This is a very important case.
Yeah, the last threads of their power, at least, that they're still hanging on to.
So this was on an inside page of the Wall Street Journal, and I haven't seen it anywhere else. I did a Google News search on the attorney's name, and it doesn't show up in Google News.
Amazing. But you're highlighting it over at opednews.com.
It's a headline article. That's one of a couple that we have that are pretty hot. The other one is about
with something that happened in Oregon, where you live. And that's the way that the tobacco companies blocked, or pretty much,
yeah, they spent $12 million on what I call highly deceptive advertising to prevent us from raising the tobacco tax to pay for health care for kids in the state. It was mind-boggling, and I think it was a test case.
And for me, what it told me, and I didn't see the connection before, was when Congress tried to override Bush's veto of the S-CHIP bill, my guess is that knocking on every member of Congress's door were lobbyists for the tobacco companies. Tobacco
right.
killed the treatment of children, the health care provision for children in this country, and that's shameful.
Yeah, I agree. Isaiah Poole over at TomPaine.com, what else do you see on your site, and what are the stories that you see coming down the road that we really should be paying attention to that aren't on the mainstream media's website or vision or whatever?
A couple of things. Well, first of all, there's a piece of good news on an item that we posted on our site last night about the standoff between the Bush administration and Congress on the Water Resources Development Bill.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bill that would fund a number of environmental projects as well as water and sewer projects around the country. Bush threatened to veto it. Now, both houses of Congress have overridden that veto. The Senate did so earlier today.
Right. This was the first veto override of his administration.
Veto override of his term, and to the consternation of people like the Heritage Foundation, who says that things like the drought that's currently affecting Georgia and that whole southern three-state southern region there, shouldn't be the federal government's business, because after all, water is a state and local matter.
Even though a watershed may cover 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 states in some cases.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. I was just looking at another thing that the Do Nothing Congress did today. Was in a Senate committee pass a bill to strengthen the Small Business Administration. This is a bill that's already gone through the House of Representatives. And if you notice, Congress has been systematically examining the contracting practices of the federal government, which have very much tilted in the favor of large private
right. And the SBA has been giving away all these things to big corporations that are supposed to go to small businesses.
Exactly.
So that's the story.
That's
okay,
the story.
That's great, and people can read it over at TomPaine.com. Rob Call, we have about a half a minute left. What do you see on the horizon here at opednews.com, Rob?
Impeachment. It's looking better and better. We've got a great article on it by Dave Lindorf, who's written a book about it, and the prospects are rosier than ever, and Nancy is looking worse than ever.
Yeah. And I think people need to realize impeachment does not require a trial in the Senate, a successful trial in the Senate, removal from office. Just impeachment in the House is enough to lay the crimes bare for everybody to see.
I think the Democrats have it all wrong. They've been afraid that it's going to waste time. I think they should just every now and then, once or twice a week, do impeachment hearings until the elections. Just keep laying the rotting carcass of the Republican Party bear.
I agree. And since the Supreme Court ruled in the Nixon case that in an impeachment investigation, you're investigating real crimes, there is no executive privilege. You would blow a hole in that. Rob Call, opednews.com, Isaiah Poole, TomPaine.com. Gentlemen, both of you, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And for the great websites you have there over at TomPaine.com and opednews.com. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shifted. It's
Yes, indeed. Tag, you're it. It is so cool when somebody writes a song using my see you later line.
Tag, you're it.
I love it. I love it. Thanks, guys. 51 minutes past the hour. George Soros warns of serious U.S. correction. This is the guy who made $1 billion betting against the Bank of England in 1992. He made billions of dollars betting against Asian currencies back in the 80s. And now, today, this from the Times Online, the Times of London, the headline, George Soros warns of serious U.S. correction. One of the world's most influential investors has said that America is on course for a worse-than-expected downturn. We should pay attention to George Soros. Jay Tamboli is on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. You are calling us from
Istanbul, Turkey, where I have been for 2 days now, and from Cairo, where I was the previous week.
Wow. What's your take on what's the possibility of Turkey and northern Iraq ending up in a conflict situation?
Well, you know, tensions here are pretty high. What we've been, you know, the impression we've really gotten is it feels a lot like the U.S. Kind of after 9/11. I mean, everywhere you look, there are Turkish flags hanging in stores. You know, we were riding in the taxi from the hotel and sort of asking the taxi driver what he thought about the Turkish or the Kurdish Workers Party, and he just flat out called them terrorists. I mean, you know, the PKK, that is the Kurdish Workers Party, has kidnapped Turkish soldiers and held them for a few days. They, you know, launched multiple attacks from northern Iraq. They are really interested in, you know, creating a separate Kurdish state and, you know, have been using force to try to achieve that end. So Turkey is very upset about this. It's been, you know, maybe a week or so since we've really seen anything happen, but tensions are very high, and I think Turkey's really looking to the U.S. to help them hold the PKK down. And if they don't, you know, if the PKK launches another attack, I think Turkey's very close into sending this into a, you know, a real conflict.
Yeah. So you're saying that Turkey right now is sort of in the height of the kind of nationalistic fervor that we had in the United States after 9/11. And
absolutely. You know, and it's, you know, it's funny because this is in many ways is like any other big European city or any big city in general. You can walk around, you know, there are stores that you see worldwide, you know, major clothing stores. There are McDonald's. There's a Starbucks down the street, which I was surprised by because I McDonald's is a global company, but Starbucks is everywhere.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they have Turkish flags hanging in their windows. You know, yeah. These companies, these stores, you think of it as, you know, American companies. You know, even they are getting into this. It is a huge deal here. Cars have flags. We saw somebody walking down the street with four Turkish, you know, big flags, you know, like 3 feet by 4 feet carrying them. You know, it's a big deal.
Wow. Now, when you were in Cairo, Mubarak. Mubarak, thank you. Mubarak, just before we invaded Iraq, publicly said, if George Bush invades Iraq, then he will create 1,000 bin Ladens, or maybe he said 100 bin Ladens. But he said, you know, if you invade Iraq, you're going to create a worse situation than you have. He has been proven right. He also had to, at one point, intervene and, for all practical purposes, basically suspend an election because it looked like the Islamists were going to take a good chunk of his country. And so he's sort of, you know, not quite democratically elected. What's going on in Egypt? What's the street like there?
Well,
and first of all, do you agree with my characterization of you know, his situation?
Well, he was, what we were attending was a conference of the National Democratic Party, which is his party, and even though technically, you know, they claim to be a democracy, it's really the ruling party of the country.
Right.
And the fear people have is that with all this, you know, turmoil around the Middle East region with, you know, the ongoing stuff in Israel-Palestine, obviously Iraq, now, you know, some of the Turkey stuff, and then, of course, in the past couple of days, we've had some issues in Georgia. The people are worried about instability because right now, Hosni Mubarak, who is the president, doesn't have a clear successor. And there's kind of an expectation his son, Gamal Mubarak, is going to be the next president. But, you know, it wasn't really clear. And so I think the purpose of this conference was really to bring Gamal Mubarak more into the spotlight, to give him a little more power. They actually passed an amendment to the party constitution that would allow Gamal Mubarak to run for president. And, you know, he gave a very good speech. I have to say, he's a great speaker, and very charismatic, and is really taking, you know, a lot of responsibility in the party. So, you know, the idea is to reassure Egyptians that even though there's all this instability, that Egypt, at least, you know, while it may not have a perfect democracy, it has a path that they're going down and has, you know, a set kind of chain of succession, because there are rumors going around about Hosni Mubarak's health. He's, you know, getting up, he's almost 70. So people wanted to be reassured that, you know, there's someone who would take that place. So,
yeah, fascinating. Jay Tamboli with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News, reporting from Istanbul, Turkey. Jay, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be broadcasting live from Phoenix, and Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us, as he has every Friday for 5 years now, taking your calls. Lou Dobbs is going to drop by on his new book, Independence Day, Awakening the American Spirit, the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.